So the title of the paper, of the talk, is Out of the Stony Rubbish, Devastation and Rebirth in Eliot's The Wasteland. On June 29, 1927, T.S. Eliot was baptized and received into the Anglican Church in a strictly private ceremony, the doors at Holy Trinity Church in London having been locked for the occasion. Reflecting on this momentous step some 5 years later, Eliot observes that, quote, the Christian scheme seemed the only possible scheme which found a place for values which I must maintain or perish. Yet another 16 years later, in 1948, Eliot remarks that particularly a person undergoing conversion from indifference to Christian belief and practice, the convert of the intellectual or sensitive type, is drawn towards the more Catholic type of worship and doctrine. To his close friends, Eliot's step came as a surprise, even as a shock, and it highlighted yet again his intensely private and complex persona. Consider Virginia Woolf's strangely apoplectic reaction upon learning of Eliot's conversion. Now, I wish I could read this out in a sort of snobby Bloomsbury accent, but I have no talent to do that, so I won't even try. I've had a most shameful and distressing interview with poor dear Tom Eliot, who may be called dead to us from this day forward. He has become an Anglo-Catholic, believes in God and immortality, and goes to church. I was really shocked. A corpse would seem to me more credible than he is. I mean, there's something obscene in a living person sitting by the fire and believing in God. This is Virginia Woolf, true to form. Woolf's vexation at this discovery, in which she naturally expects her sister Vanessa, the addressee of this letter, to share, reveals the remarkably complacent liberal secular worldview held by her Bloomsbury friends, as well as their pathologizing appraisal of those who have made other commitments. Eliot himself, of course, was well aware of the atheist creed that was not just presumed by intellectual elites such as the Bloomsbury group, but was also implicit in the stunted moral imagination of his times more generally. Thus he distinguishes between a metaphysical indifference pervading his culture as a whole and a narrow elite for which denial of God and the spiritual life has assumed the status of a dogma. The former he calls the good or white atheists, presumably a reference to the Russian Revolution, in contrast to the people like Bertrand Russell and John Middleton Murray, who are bad or red atheists, as he puts it. The latter, he notes, show what a dark age of gross superstition we still live in. For if the Middle Ages, and this is Eliot writing, for if the Middle Ages were a period of scientific superstition, ours is an age of philosophic superstition. It simply assumes that the only problems confronting us are of a technical, epistemological or political nature, challenges that are inherently within the scope of human comprehension and thus susceptible of man-made solution. In good dialectical fashion, then, Eliot remarks, quote, how atheism should always be encouraged for the sake of the faith. For the main problem is not doubt, but careless unbelief, itself the mirror of an unreflective religiosity that 3 decades later the young Joseph Ratzinger will call the Church of the Pagans. More specifically, with regard to literary production, Eliot likewise distinguishes between what might be called the poetry of doubt and the poetry of unbelief. The former is exemplified for Eliot by Matthew Arnold and Thomas Hardy. It is essentially parasitical, depending, as it does, upon the fact that other people have believed things and upon being determined by other people's beliefs. What the shrill and imperceptive response of Eliot's Bloomsbury friends failed to grasp is that Eliot's conversion had, in fact, been in the making for quite some time. Eliot's official reception into the Anglican Church in June 1927 had concluded a process of scrupulous self-examination and prolonged discernment by a poet who, echoing John Henry Newman's conversion, like to point out that, quote, I hate spectacular conversions. The doors of the church were locked. He didn't want anybody to be involved or a witness. This was a private, a purely private event. Nearly a year prior to this momentous step in 1927, Eliot still appeared hesitant. In such a wilderness or desert, as he puts it, mid-1920s London, his spiritual steps towards Anglo-Catholicism struck him as obscure and doubtful at best. The wilderness, of course, had been almost eponymously captured in The Wasteland, the poem that brought Eliot lasting fame, and that, in the view of many, had captured more powerfully than any other literary work the existential disorientation and the damaged psyche of post-World War I Europe. Published 5 years before Eliot's conversion in late 1922, The Wasteland unfolds the specter of modern existence in a startlingly new idiom. At once cryptic and vivid, the poem's language reflects modern life as a scene of emotional and spiritual devastation. Morally confused, its expressive resources atrophied and utterly adrift in the shabby, almost illegible world of metropolitan London. The discursive world of Eliot's poem is at one of disjointed chatter and clatter, as he puts it, anticipating the chatter, das Gerede, of which Heidegger will later speak in Being and Time. We encounter sundry individuals engaged in impersonating some coveted identity or persona, rather than seeking to discern and grow into the being they properly are. We overhear fragments of conversation, such as a Russian expatriate implausibly claiming German ethnicity at a Bavarian cafe. Bin gar keine Russin, stamm aus Litauen, echt Deutsch. We briefly listen in on two working-class women at a London pub, one advising the other on how to contrive the undamaged, youthful female persona that her husband will expect to meet upon returning from the trenches. Now Albert's coming back. Make yourself a bit smart. He'll want to know what you've done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He's been in the army 4 years. He wants a good time. And if you don't give it him, there's others will. Eliot's dystopic 1920s London, quote, the brown land filled with empty bottles, sandwich papers, silk handkerchiefs, cardboard boxes, cigarette ends, and so forth, is both a literal place and a mythic parable of human life adrift within what Augustine had long before called empty, distended time. And yet, for the reader to grasp the utter destitution of modern life, some transcendent point of reference, some token of eschatological hope is required. Where despair is experienced, there must have first been hope, faith, and love. Some glimpse, that is, of the possibility that life could, in principle, attain meaning and fulfill its inner telos, a possibility that, even as it seems all but unattainable, can never be dismissed as mere illusion or projection. Simply put, what The Wasteland asks of us is not to affirm, but to transcend the damaged world it depicts. Self-recognition, not resignation, is where the poem points us. And for that to occur, we must resist a common mistake, known in critical circles as the imitative fallacy, that has often been committed by readers of The Wasteland. That is, we must resist the naive assumption that in capturing the, quote, spiritually indigent condition of modern life, Eliot effectively asks us to acquiesce in it. To construe Eliot's depiction of human life as haplessly adrift between birth and death, anxious, disoriented, and disillusioned, not only as the prevailing reality, but also as delimiting all human possibility, would be a serious misreading. Instead, we are enjoined not to mimic, but to transcend that reality by discerning the moral disorder and failure exhibited by individuals and communities in the poem. Let us now consider two very different, though equally representative, instances of moral crisis in the poem. First, let us follow Eliot's poem where he ponders the tension-fraught relationship between sexuality and love, which turns out to offer us much insight into modernity's flawed notion of the human person. By person, I refer to the unique human being constituted by her relations with other persons, capable of reflection, reasoning, and responsible choice, as a participant in various types of communities, intellectual, economic, political, and spiritual. Now, in order to show why personhood is an idea with which we ought to be concerned, let us consider a passage from The Wasteland in which the criteria of human personhood just mentioned are being variously ignored or violated. Modeled on Buddha's sermon about worldly things to be consumed by fire, part 3 of The Wasteland offers one of the most despondent moments of interpersonal failure and sin in modern literature. The scene is the grimy metropolitan dystopia of London, the unreal city, as Eliot calls it, a disenchanted place, seemingly bereft of love, a place from which, quote, the nymphs are departed and have left no address. Titled The Fire Sermon, this section features a speaker condemned, like his mythical forebear, Tiresias, and like Eliot's poetic and intellectual alter egos, Dante and Pascal, to foresee and to ponder the inevitable miscarriage of love and the seemingly boundless depravity of humankind. The particular scene in question involves the encounter between a humble typist and a nameless clerk, whom she has invited for dinner. Her confused expectations of romantic love and unfulfilled longing appear rooted more in the sense of despair than possibility. In uniquely concise phrasing, Eliot conveys to us the typist's all-encompassing sense of her solitary, loveless, and insubstantial existence, a life so monotonous and bereft of meaning as almost to deprive her of any sense of personhood. Tellingly, she has no name. With her drab, monotonous existence, the typist notably resembles Eliot's own professional setting as an employee of Lloyd's Bank, day after day reviewing reams of foreign currency transactions in a windowless basement. She also recalls Eliot's earlier poetic creation of J. Alfred Prufrock, who in the poet's unsparing phrase has, quote, measured out his life with coffee spoons. The following scene charts the typist's sexual encounter with a young man carbuncular, an event as dispiriting, degrading, and bewildering as few others in modern poetry. Known solely by their humdrum occupations, both the clerk and the typist evoke Dante's nocturnal downward trajectory into a world of lost souls in the inferno, a world defined by counterfeit love and by a total failure of self-recognition. And here's the first of the long passages that you will find on the handout from Eliot's poem. At the violet hour, when the eyes and back turn upward from the desk, when the human engine waits like a taxi throbbing, waiting, I, Tiresias, though blind, throbbing between two lives, old man with wrinkled female breasts, can see at the violet hour the evening hour that strives homeward and brings the sailor home from sea, the typist home at tea time, clears her breakfast, lights her stove, and lays out food in tins. Out of the window, perilously spread, her drying combinations touched by the sun's last rays. On the divan are piled, at night her bed, stockings, slippers, camisoles, and stays. I, Tiresias, old man with wrinkled dugs, perceived the scene and foretold the rest. I, too, awaited the expected guest. He, the young man carbuncular, arrives. A small house agent's clerk with one bold stare, one of the low on whom assurance sits as a silk hat on a Bradford millionaire. The time is now propitious, as he guesses. The meal is ended, she is bored and tired, endeavors to engage her in caresses, which still are unreproved if undesired. Flushed and decided, he assaults at once. Exploring hands encounter no defense. His vanity requires no response and makes a welcome of indifference. And I, Tiresias, have foresuffered all and acted on the same divan or bed. I, who have sat by Thebes below the wall and walked among the lowest of the dead, bestows one final patronizing kiss and gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit. She turns and looks a moment in the glass, hardly aware of her departed lover. Her brain allows one half-formed thought to pass. Well, now that's done, and I'm glad it's over. When lovely woman stoops to folly and paces about her room again, alone, she smoothes her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. At once deceived and self-deceived, the typist ends up exchanging the reciprocal I-thou relationship of love for the torrid, impersonal realm of third-person mechanical desire. As they emerge from their fleeting and dispiriting encounter, the woman and the young man have evolved into allegories of spiritual destitution and despoiled love. Notably, both the man and the woman appear not to have grasped at all the profound harm wrought by the hapless and fleeting encounter. The clerk's furtive departure, he gropes his way, finding the stairs unlit, faintly recalls the pagan naturalism of Protagoras and Democritus, resembling, as it does, the erratic trajectory of an atom. He appears unintelligible to himself, nothing more than the human engine, whose violation of the forlorn woman had been foreseen with harrowing accuracy by the mythical seer Tiresias, who here functions as the speaker. The scene's failure of love and recognition exposes a naturalistic, indeed hedonistic psychology that in a liberal secular urban world has become all but normal. In Eliot's dystopic portrayal of the clerk's metrosexual persona, Augustine's Ordo Amoris, the order of love, has been supplanted by the idolatry of subjective preference. Unrestrained self-fulfillment has effectively vanquished the Christian good of a communion grounded in love. As it retraces the mythic cruelty long foresuffered by Tiresias, Eliot's Fire Sermon presents us with a neo-pagan modernity, defined above all by the utter failure of love and self-recognition. The coherence of the Augustinian understanding of human personhood has been eclipsed by a dissociated and often feral modern psyche. And yet, it would be a mistake to characterize the scenario with which Eliot presents us as simply one of failure. For the above episode from the Wasteland does not simply identify a failure, but in fact intimates a fault, indeed an instance of sin. So what exactly is the focus of sin in the passage we've just been considering? A first step toward answering that question will be to ask how the two individuals in this passage see themselves. Clearly, the typist and the clerk's self-image is such that in each instance, it renders them incapable of truly seeing and acknowledging the respective other. We noted before that neither character has a name, but instead is only known by his or her occupation. Yet only where the individual has a name does he or she become a person. For the name makes something into someone, makes it nameable, invocable. As Josef Ratzinger puts it, through the name, the other enters into the structure, so to speak, of my fellow humanity. Yet precisely this all-important step from a merely formal cognition of the other as a human being to her ethical recognition as a person proves elusive here. Thus, both the typist and the clerk appear to understand themselves and the other only as solitary, hermetic selves, more a something than a someone. But still, the question remains, can we say that this failure of recognition and self-recognition is truly a case of sin? I believe we can and indeed must do so. For to regard oneself as an isolated agent and to consider that the only way of being in the world still means to have embraced a self-image, a badly distorted self-image, to be sure, but nonetheless a self-image for which one will henceforth be responsible. Thus, the clerk's dehumanizing and ethically indefensible actions cannot simply be dismissed as some entailment of his feral nature. Rather, he bears as much responsibility for his hedonism as he does for violating the spirit of the meal at which he had been the expected guest. A failed Eucharist, if ever there was one. The clerk's existentialist disposition cannot simply be explained away as a consequence of some nature inexorably at work within him. For the human person is not simply some generic pure nature, as the 16th century theologian Baius had hypostatized, to which a name may eventually become attached. No, a person's nature is not some bundle of instincts and capabilities variously encountered in the human as a species. Rather, it is a gift, honored or dishonored, a potentially cultivated or potentiality cultivated or abused by each individual as he defines himself in the temporal order through so many choices, habits, and acts. Something of the sort probably led Abraham Lincoln to surmise that every man over 40 is responsible for his face. Let that sink in. For the nature that reveals itself with such seeming inevitability in the clerk's predatory behavior is ultimately something he has made and for which he is now responsible. Arguing with that quote, "Where there is sin, there is multiplicity, yet where there is virtue, there is unity," the early patristic writer Origen had long ago stressed that where love is disfigured by desire and where the fullness, presence, and mutual recognition of persons in communion is compromised, we are not confronted by some incidental failure, but with a fault of deliberation, choice, and will. The so-called failure of personhood is not a failure at all. It is a case of sin. Eliot's clerk sins against the imago Dei, not only of the typist, but just as plainly also against his own. Read against the backdrop of carefully embedded allusions to the rape of Philomela, the impersonal and dispiriting encounter here unfolded proves, if anything, more ghastly yet. For in modern urban, secular, and casually hedonistic culture, the violation of love and thus of the human person, whose flourishing is to arise from love, has become the new normal. What makes the scene's closing line so acutely disturbing is the seismographic sensitivity with which Eliot's writing registers the slightest tremors of spiritual anguish in the typist's half-formed thought. Well, now that's done. And also in the distracted and mechanical movements with which she fends off awareness of her own casual violation and self-abasement. She smooths her hair with automatic hand and puts a record on the gramophone. Let us now take a look at another strategy in which the wasteland invites us to discern seeds of spiritual flourishing within its outwardly desolate world. As early as December 1922, the critic Edward Wilson had noted that, quote, "The wasteland is only the hero's arid soul, a desert that has always been there and therefore is less a place than a concrete image of spiritual drought." Opening the poem's final section, "What the Thunder Said," is a profusion of biblical references, some of which I have sort of in the margins, I think, identified on the handout. A profusion of biblical references, beginning with the section's very title, an allusion to John chapter 12, and continuing with the agony in the stony places, alluding to John 18 and Psalm 141, and the general evocation of Christ's arrest, interrogation, and crucifixion, referencing Matthew 26. The section's first stanza winds up with an oblique reference to the dysfunctional community in the present. Quote, "We who were living and now are dying with a little patience," which in turn recalls 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and Revelation chapter 1. Add to that a panoply of other intertextual allusions to Dostoevsky, Hermann Hesse, Walter Pater, Rudyard Kipling, and a host of minor writers, and we find ourselves confronting less an instance of poetic expression than we are witnessing a quasi-scriptural revelation of sorts. The language of the wasteland resists being decoded according to the dominant naturalistic epistemologies of Eliot's time: scientism, historicism, skepticism, positivism. Instead, it saddles us with an experience that, though often disorienting, ultimately has a liberating effect. As one of Eliot's better readers, Dennis Donahue, has remarked, quote, "In the wasteland, quote, the word," and this is also on the handout, I believe, "the word has lost its prescribed relations, but for that very reason it has acquired a magical power, become complete in itself, a revelation in its own recesses. Giving up its dependency, the word acquires sibylline presence. Such words, since they cannot be continuous with nature, must be above or below it, two conditions equally desolate. They are exceptions deprived of a rule. These words become names because of their oracular power. But what they name, they cannot be defined." It's interesting how at the opening of his book, Dennis Donahue remembers first reading Eliot. And he had read various other modern poets who he also thought were extraordinarily gifted. But he said the difference was, with Eliot, he would immediately remember every line. The other poets, he couldn't. And there is this oracular power, this haunting power of Eliot's formulations that I think many of us probably have already experienced. Donahue is very good in pointing this out. So to an unprecedented degree, the closing section of The Wasteland achieves an utterly impersonal voice. Indeed, voice here seems no longer tethered to the biographical individual known as T.S. Eliot. Indeed, instead, it constitutes a quasi-prophetic medium, an impression also underscored by the fact that Eliot had written the entire closing section of The Wasteland in a single day. By situating himself in close proximity to the voices singing out of empty cisterns and exhausted wells, Eliot aligns his poem with the prophetic books, especially in this allusion to chapter 2, and perhaps also to Joseph trapped in the well, Genesis 37. Divine inspiration and potential salvation presuppose that we who find ourselves, quote, "on the sandy road winding above among the mountains," first acknowledge our spiritual abandonment and isolation. Let us consider some of the lines from the opening of this final section of The Wasteland. What the thunder said. "After the torchlight red on sweaty faces, after the frosty silence in the gardens, and after the agony in stony places, the shouting and the crying, prison and palace and reverberation of thunder of spring over distant mountains, he who was living is now dead. We who were living are now dying with a little patience. Here is no water but only rock, and no water, and the sandy road, the road winding above among the mountains, which are mountains of rock without water. If there were water, we should stop and drink amongst the rock. One cannot stop, or think sweat is dry and feet are in the sand. If there were only water amongst the rock, dead mountain mouth of carious teeth that cannot spit. Here one can neither stand nor lie nor sit. There is not even silence in the mountains, but dry, sterile thunder without rain. There is not even solitude in the mountains, but red, sullen faces sneer and snarl from doors of mud-cracked houses. If there were water." Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together. But when I look up, ahead, up the white road, there's always another one walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman, but who is that on the other side of you? The world evoked in such catatonic, minimalist language is one of both spiritual and ecological devastation, and as such, it truly represents the dissociation of sensibility that Eliot had diagnosed as the fundamental pathology of his time. To those who, like Virginia Woolf, Bertrand Russell, or his friend John Middleton Murray, maintain that in fact modern society has fulfilled the promise of the Enlightenment, and, as Nietzsche so mockingly put it, has actually abolished suffering, Eliot has a twofold answer. It is neither true, nor would it be a good thing if it were. Responding to Murray, he writes, and I think this is also on the handout, "Do you really consider it a good sign that the time of stony places is over? If so, you are luckier than the Savior, who found things pretty stony to the last, and would, I believe, have continued to find them so, had he not been removed at an age less ripe than yours or mine. I do not suppose that I share any other characteristic of the founder of Christianity, but at least I have nothing but stony places to look forward to. This isolates me, of course, from those who can pass in and out of stony places with practiced ease." Eliot's central point here is simple and in substance recalls Augustine's critique of Pelagius' claim that salvation can be effected by the human being's innate capacities. Echoing the Bishop of Hippo, Eliot insists that modern civilization, like all human endeavors that have preceded it, cannot redeem itself from its intrinsically sinful condition. Indeed, unlike earlier cultures, modernity suffers this additional grave disadvantage of not even acknowledging the category of sin. It thus lacks the elemental self-recognition without which there cannot be salvation, ever. Hence, the lines just quoted present us with a civilization not merely struggling, but on the verge of expiring. The land is parched, sterile, unpropitious of life, an ecological disaster zone. As a sentimental agrarian, Eliot would have known Wordsworth, Hopkins, and Arnold's critique of a world, as Hopkins puts it famously, smeared and blared with trade. Indeed, he had seen up close the man-made deserts created by the Homestead Acts of 1862 and 1909, which had allocated 160 acres, increased to 320 acres by 1909, to any settler who would put down a $10 filing fee. The result had been rampant deforestation of land owned by the railroad companies, particularly near riverbeds. An evangelical manual of the time, Campbell's Soil Culture, even advocated pulverizing topsoil with the absurd promise that, quote, rain follows the plow. Robert Frost's poem, The Census Taker, written shortly before The Wasteland, though published just a little bit afterwards, describes such a landscape south of Montreal as, quote, an emptiness flayed to the very stone, a desert. So where then do Eliot's abundant allusions to scripture, metaphysical poetry, and sundry religious and philosophical meditations leave us? Implicitly, his poetry, a montage of prophetic, conversational, and stylized poetic speech, becomes intelligible in proportion as we are able to transcend the monochrome existentialist matrix in which the poem's personae appear trapped. Take the shrewd twofold allusion to Christ's unseen presence on the road to Emmaus, Luke chapter 24, and also encountered in Dante, Purgatorio 21. It is this motif of an unseen and yet distinctly felt presence, the third, who walks always beside you, that overturns any straightforward existentialist reading of those hordes swarming over endless plains, stumbling in the cracked earth, ringed by the flat horizon only. Inspired by Hermann Hesse's essay collection from 1920, Blick ins Chaos, A Gaze into Chaos, which notably contains a profound meditation on Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov and the downfall of Europe, as the essay is titled, Eliot's haunting image of interminable horizontal movement may be punctured by the recognition of Christ wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded, who is always among those wandering in darkness. Even the starkest scenes of desolation, that is, contain seeds of a possible transcendence. The passage recalls a faint yet insistent symbolism early in the wasteland, which cannot be assimilated to a purely immanent conception of existence. Lines, quote, such as, "Your shadow at morning striding behind you," or "Your shadow at evening rising to meet you," "I will show you fear in a handful of dust." Such lines arguably foreshadow the image of parched and abject life evoked at the end of the poem. Now, a resolutely secular modernity, committed as it is to utterly remaking the natural world by technological means, no longer knows fear or humility. After all, fear presupposes, and Deuteronomy chapter 10 would be a good passage to reference here, fear presupposes a transcendent God. And as the Apostle John writes, such fear can only be overcome by love. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. 1 John chapter 4. By contrast, as Heidegger was to argue in Being and Time in 1927, modern civilization is consumed not by fear, but by what he calls angst, anxiety, and by psychosomatic neurosis. "My nerves are bad tonight," says a nameless woman early in the wasteland. Unlike fear, that is, anxiety has no identifiable object, no transcendent point of reference. Instead, it arises from the lingering suspicion that our technological means and theoretical calculations may suddenly fail us, possibly producing entirely unintended and potentially devastating consequences, such as the Dust Bowl that Eliot already foresaw. For Eliot, then, the catatonic movement of hordes swarming over endless plains is first and foremost a vision of hell, of time experienced as no more than empty extension, durée, as Henri Bergson calls it, a flat horizon. Writing to Paul Elmer Moore in 1930, he remarks, this might also be the last quote on the handout, "The man who disbelieves in any future, life, whatever it is, also..." Sorry, let me start that again. "The man who disbelieves in any future life, whatever, is also a believer in hell. If there is no future life, then hell is for such people here and now, and I can see nothing worse in a hell which endures to eternity, and a hell which endures until mere annihilation. The mere stretch of endless time, which is the only way in which we can ordinarily apprehend immortal life." In the wasteland, then, Eliot traces this, quote, "stretch of endless time," not for its own sake, but so as to begin to glimpse the immortal life that is almost, though never entirely, occluded by modern culture's heap of broken images. Alluding to Ezekiel chapter 3, Eliot is the prophetic voice, son of man, pressing on its quest for meaning in a world of unbelief. All along, that is, the wasteland's fragmented survey of a devastated modernity had been undertaken in order to glimpse an answer to the one inescapable question, the question of hope. What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Thank you. Yes, that's, of course, it's surely that would be the first reference.
And it makes
reference.
It a less generous push to that passage of the poem, by the way.
I mean, it's a, it's more than a can of worms. It's a whole pallet full of cans of worms. Rather unappetizing image, I admit. But the relationship of Vivian and T.S. Eliot is incredibly complex and has been, as you probably know, subject to endless of second guessing by biographers and critics. What is certainly not in doubt is that Vivian was suffering from severe and deteriorating, as you noted, sort of mental issues, and eventually ended up sometime in the early 1930s permanently in a mental hospital. I think my nerves are bad tonight. However, given that I have, for instance, I've read through all of Eliot's correspondence until the early 1930s so far. Lots of volumes. The letters from the early 1920s, while he's writing The Wasteland, would suggest that that phrase is just as applicable to him as it would be to her. For one thing, if you look at those letters, you find that they are incredibly catatonic themselves. They are sort of purely business letters. Even when he is working, as he is working very hard, starting in 22, on the Criterion, the journal that he edits. So it's all, but he's working full-time at the bank, and then he's working another full-time job at home late at night, trying to get this journal going. And then, of course, there's domestic difficulty arising from this unfortunate marriage that he had quite imprudently entered into. And so he was depressed. He was, and the letters show it. The shift in tone is dramatic when you get to 1925, and he's given up his job at Lloyd's Bank and is now beginning to be fully engaged with the journal. It's like the windows have suddenly been opened and there is fresh air in the room. Until then, I think this description would apply just as much to him as to other characters. Yes.
Thank you for your lecture. Do you see, you bring up Eliot's notions of time in The Wasteland. Do you see the four core texts as a direct response to what he posits in The Wasteland, both the time and maybe the fear also?
Yes. So the four quartets is, of course, is about 14 years later, right? So the first of them, Burnt Norton, is from 1936. A great deal has happened since. Eliot has evolved into a sort of man of letters, so become a very respected figure at the publishing house of Faber. I think you are right, though, that when it comes to the thinking and meditating about time, the four quartets are, as you suggested, a response, and that means, to some extent, also a rejoinder. What I have tried to draw out in The Wasteland, quite against the grain, I might add, of most academic criticism on the poem, which tends to rejoice when the news is bad, and which tends to sort of favor, sort of reinforcing what it perceives to be the existentialist and dystopian credo of the poem. What I have tried to draw out, of course, is that nobody writes poetry that is purely an expression of despair. Animating the very effort of writing such a poem at all must be some glimmer of hope that in and by means of this writing, a different perspective will be opened. I do, in fact, I would take this so far as to say that I don't see how writing poetry is really possible without some form of hope. And so The Wasteland is obviously a much greater challenge when it comes to identifying ways in which that hope breaks through, because the dramatic structure of the scenes is such that they seem to sort of exhibit the worst in human behavior, ecological devastation, and that prophetic vision is overwhelmingly dystopian. And yet when it comes to questions like who is the third one always walking beside you, those allusions are too insistent. And they're also at the tonal level, they register with such an eerie presence that they cannot be assimilated to a purely naturalistic reading of the poem. They in a way ask us, they invite us, indeed in a way they enjoin us to overcome the matrix of perception that is held by, in which the characters of the poem itself appear to be trapped. And yet, that kind of more, that so those glimpses of hope and faith are minimal, and one has to really be very attentive to them. One can easily miss them. Now, in Four Quartets, that scenario is substantially changed. So here time is no longer linear in that sense, but has in fact a much more kind of Meisterstück-like quality to it. And maybe I never travel without them. So when you look at the famous opening of Four Quartets, time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. What might have been is an abstraction, remaining a perpetual possibility only in a world of speculation. But then, you know, there is always this intimation of time opening up on the eschaton. I've recently published an essay on the question of eschatology in Four Quartets, especially in Little Gidding. It is striking how here Eliot's concern, I mean, there are still moments in Four Quartets, like, for instance, in the second poem, East Coker, when people go into the underground, into the sublunar cave, as in the Miltonic allusion, as he puts it, to shelter themselves from the bombing raids of Hitler's Air Force, right? And in London. And they go down, and they sort of sit in the dark, and it's sort of like the dark night of the soul that one encounters in John of the Cross. But those are moments where the population from the wasteland seems to have been back in the poem. It's suddenly back. But the scene is now unreal, whereas in a way that is much more, I would say, much more emphatic than in the wasteland. In the wasteland, the dystopian scenes about London could still sort of be assimilated to a realistic picture of London. In Four Quartets, those scenes seem to be overtly allegorical. And I think that's the point is perhaps put simply this way. Reading The Wasteland requires that we as readers find some form of exodus from the dystopian world that it presents. In Four Quartets, unless one has already achieved a perspective of hope and contemplation and quietness and stillness, a deeply meditative poem, unless one has sort of achieved that, life in London actually is unlivable. So for Eliot, conversion to Christianity, as he says in that letter I quoted at the beginning, was really in many ways a matter of survival. The world was unendurable otherwise. It became possible, in a certain sense, even with a certain level of equanimity, to look at the numberless crowds flowing across, the bridge into London, from that famous image early in The Wasteland. It was possible to look at them with a certain degree of equanimity once he had converted. But unless that had happened, it would have been unendurable to stay in that city. So time has to have now an eschatological dimension to it. That's merely being intimated in The Wasteland. In Four Quartets, it's the premise without which the poem cannot really be effectively read, I think. Sorry for the long-winded answer.
Thank you, Dr. Fowle. I'm thinking about the medieval view of nature where there is a sort of acknowledgement of a chaos, subjection of wilderness to sin and disorder, and yet there's also acknowledgement of God's glory within creation. It seems like maybe Hopkins represents that, maybe also Victorian sort of medievalism. But the sense I'm getting is that for Eliot, the world is not charged with the grandeur of God. So I'm just wondering if that's true, or if not, how might nature be charged with the grandeur of God?
Well, it certainly would be very difficult, perhaps impossible, to claim that the world is charged with the grandeur of God in the wasteland. That would be, I think, implausible. But Eliot, by the way, was an interested but somewhat incomprehending reader of Hopkins. There are a couple of letters, by the way, just out of, you know, sort of biographical interest, in which he comments on reading Hopkins, who had for the first time only been published, really, for the general audience in 1918, in that edition that Robert Bridges had produced. Anyway, nature in Eliot's poetry does not have a very prominent place in the way that it does in Hopkins. Eliot is a Londoner. He's a being who, in a way, observes modern civilization, to use a euphemistic term. He observes it primarily in its metropolitan form. He's a man of the city. His office at Lloyd's Bank was underground. It had these glass bricks that admitted a little bit of light on the sidewalk, so all day he would sit at the desk, bow down, looking at figures, while people were literally walking over his head back and forth. That was nature. So you would have to admit a somewhat reduced picture of it. There are beautiful moments when he's in four quartets, however, when he's in the countryside. And there are striking images absolutely worthy of Hopkins, such as that extraordinary one early on in Burnt Norton, where he speaks of being at this burned manor house and seeing the unheard and hearing, quote, the unheard music hidden in the shrubbery and the unseen eye beam crossed. For the roses had the look of flowers that are looked at. It's a great line. There they were, as our guests, accepting and accepted and accepting. So we moved, and they, in a formal pattern, along the empty alley into the box circle, to look down into the drained pool. Dry, the pool, dry, concrete, brown-edged. And the pool was filled with water out of sunlight, and the lotus rose quietly. Quietly, the surface glittered out of heart of light. And they were behind us, reflected in the pool. Then a cloud passed, and the pool was empty. So this moment, this epiphanic moment, where suddenly a sort of fullness of natural splendor breaks through. But it is nature here that sort of oscillates between something simply imagined / recalled and something actually seen. We can't be sure. Was it a vision? Was it a perception? The poem hesitates, you know. It sort of equivocates. So where I might... you said at the beginning of your question, though, and I was a little curious here, that in medieval thought, nature can also be problematic, fallen, something like that. How had you formulated it?
I think of like a forest where there's things out there. There's demonic activity.
Oh, okay. Yes, so... Right, that I don't think that dimension shows up in Eliot, nor does he quite sort of invest nature with this sort of abundant and, you know, sort of opulent visual splendor of Hopkins. No. The world isn't charged with the grandeur of God quite in that way, unless perhaps one were to understand the word charged, as I think we must. Hopkins doesn't just say it is charged in the sense of infused, but the charge is also ours to perceive it. And in that sense, I think Eliot would agree. So the charge is also an enjoinder to us that we must participate in that splendor. It's not something to be hedonistically consumed, but it is something to be also theologically considered. In that sense, Eliot, I think, would have found sympathies for that great line.
So a question on the darkness of the wasteland.
Yes.
The fact that it comes from such a dark spot
mm-hmm.
in the poet's soul. Where do the glimmers of hope come from? Because there are glimmers of hope. You've alluded to them.
Mm-hmm.
And if there isn't a beginning or an incipient Christianity at work
mm-hmm.
during this time, as there may have been later, where do the glimmers of hope come from?
Well, here we have a problem. The main problem is that Eliot is, as he was famously called, the man of many voices. Right? Eliot is capable of conjuring in the space of four or five words a phrase that sort of evokes an idiom, but it's never his. He is remarkably unself-disclosing. So when it comes to sort of asking that question you just posed, Eliot's reticence is legendary. I do think that Eliot was always, as a man, as a very young man already, I mean, the early poetry from 1909 forward, you know, Invention of the March Hare, these are poems that in a way already give us little nuggets of what will eventually be writ large in the wasteland. That is, the world is strangely opaque. It is not legible. People seem to do things that are manifestly self-destructive or aimless and in all kinds of ways symptomatic of pervasive confusion and corruption. And so there is some necessity, no doubt, to find a way to live otherwise. And I think that's what I meant earlier on when I said, you know, to write poetry is in a way inconceivable unless there is a sort of core motive of hope. Now, Eliot came from a Unitarian family. If I may be forgiven this sort of harsh sort of statement, but that's, how, I think, how Eliot came to see it. I mean, Unitarianism for him was sort of Christianity on life support. It was sort of the most sort of watered-down form of Christianity, and when he actually came up to the priest in London to discuss his conversion, it was decided that he had to be baptized. Because the baptism of the Unitarian Church was not considered valid. And Eliot had no problem with that at all. What troubled him most, that's why I sort of brought up early in the presentation these remarks about the sort of casual indifference to religion. What troubled him more than the kind of, you know, self-congratulatory atheism of the elite, which is easily recognized, is a kind of faux religiosity, the kind of veneer of bourgeois respectability that entails once a week going to church and not trying to look too deeply into those things that get said there. The Unitarianism of his forebears was to him both a mystery and something he wanted to sort of understand. And understand it he did by emancipating himself from it, by taking religion seriously. So I think what troubled him, to come back to your initial question, is the sort of the gray zone between complete agnosticism and a kind of paper-thin veneer of religious culture that's sort of just a residue of what it had once been. That was the greatest danger to a spiritually examined life, this kind of compromise, a religion purely a social form. And so that's why I think when he looked around in London, and he took a great interest, for instance, in the 1920s and 30s, in the fact that church attendance in England was falling rapidly. The Wasteland is about a generation that had gone through the Great War. They had been psychologically damaged, those who had gone, and also those who had stayed behind and had to deal with those who came back, few as they were. So he saw all that. And he thought, surely, if we are to save ourselves, then religion is either nothing at all, and we should accept that, or we must really take it seriously. And so I think that's the Wasteland is, in a way, sort of the most comprehensive attempt at a thorough diagnosis of his culture and of his own state. Earlier poems had already pointed in that direction.
That's really interesting, because what you're saying is he could have jumped in the direction of just increased agnosticism, just a very formal position, or he could have gone in the direction of adopting and embracing Christianity. There would have been, the grayness could have been gone, and he chose one rather than the other.
But I think I would add this to it. After the Wasteland, he could have done either of those things. But if he had done the first of them, he couldn't have written any more poetry.
Maybe it would have been different.
That would have been after. If this is where you are, where you end up in the Wasteland, what else are you going to say? It's notable that for the next 3 years he writes no poetry at all. And then he writes one more poem that is sort of seemingly in the vein of the Wasteland, The Hollow Man, 1925, which is, however, almost like a sort of Reader's Digest version of the Wasteland. It's sort of, the language has now been sort of almost collapsed on itself. It's become so catatonic, it's actually almost unendurable. There was nothing more to be said in that vein. The only way to continue writing poetry was to find some way for poetry and the virtue of hope to enter into a meaningful relationship, which is what he then begins to do in 1927 with Ash Wednesday.
Thank you, Doctor. So at the beginning, closer at the beginning of your talk, you reflected just one of the beginning passages just about the idea of kind of self-recognition.
Mm-hmm.
I know, especially within phenomenology, JP3 touches on this within his theology of the body, on the idea of self-consciousness. Do you mind reflecting a little bit more on that idea of self-recognition or self-consciousness, especially with perhaps its necessity in order to actually enter into a real communion or relationship with someone else?
Right. It's interesting you bring up JP2, because the young, relatively young, Karol Wojtyła, in his 1960 book, Love and Responsibility, an extraordinary book, actually, considering the time in which it was written and the place where it was written, certainly focuses, as does that scene from the Fire Sermon, on the way that sexuality, human sexuality in particular, sort of puts to the test, in the most crystallizes in a way, both the essential necessity of self-recognition and the unbelievable difficulty of it. And I think that's true, and one could, I think, find interesting parallels between those two works. Now, I do think, however, that for Eliot, the great guide to the drama of self-recognition was Dante. If you look at the Inferno, what do all the characters in the Inferno have in common? They are all incapable of self-recognition. They are all, first of all, it's the failure of self-recognition. Dante was a great writer when it comes also to using the quasi-sculptural placement and positioning of the people in his poetry, embodied beings, by sort of placing them in such a way as to embody literally their spiritual failure. So they are all, notably in Dante, in the Inferno, they are all immobile.
They're all stuck. And of course, when Dante heads down into the progressively sort of more infernal circles of hell, and especially on those occasions where Virgil doesn't restrain him and he chats up some of the sinners down there, the first thing they tell him is, I shouldn't be here. You know, this is all wrong. And so, the first thing out of everyone's mouth is essentially a testimony to the fact that they have failed at self-recognition. They cannot recognize their own sin, which is why they will never exit. Because it's less they're sort of being physically trapped than that the physical entrapment in which they suffer, say a bishop sort of stuck in a rock, Ruggiero, right, is merely a metaphor for their mental incapacity of self-recognition. That's where I think Eliot sort of principally got that. But what really connects Dante very interestingly to the text by Caro Votiva is precisely this sense that the body, the human body, also in its sexual dimensions, is sort of the most conspicuous indication of whether or not we are capable of self-recognition. I mean, Dante captures that beautifully in the Purgatory, right? The wonderful thing is the sort of ease of motion with which the characters slowly, never rushing, at the preordained pace, move up the mountain of Purgatory. And when Dante comes up to them, they're always welcoming. They're always smiling and inviting him. They gladly tell him what they had done. Right? They are capable of narrative. And narrative, in a certain sense, there becomes a condition of their spiritual liberation. Whereas the characters in the Inferno, they see the narrative only in such a way that they somehow have ended up being victims of it, never agents. They were never the doers of the things that got them there. So it's fascinating to see that. Eliot was a great reader and, of course, also a great commentator on Dante's poetry, as you may know. Wrote several essays. His 1922 essay on Dante is widely anthologized, still one of the finest pieces. So that, by the way, 1922, he's just writing The Wasteland, right? So there he's all already commenting on Dante. It's in the air, except, you know, Virginia Woolf didn't get the memo. But, so.
She missed a lot.
Yes, I am afraid on this one she did. Perceptive though she was in other ways.
All right, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. Dr. Fowle,
thank you
again for being here.
Thank you.